If South Africa wishes to survive as a unitary state, not to fragment and break up into enclaves, a kind of balkanization. Remember, it's a very young country, only really comes together 110 years ago or so. If it wishes to do that, and if it wishes to remain a member of the liberal democratic order, then it needs to vastly improve its economic performance to create the kind of society in which any child born into it can rightly aspire to a middle-class standard of living. And if it fails at that and continues to exclude vast numbers, particularly young people, from full participation in the economy, the opinion in South Africa will later radicalize, and the country will fragment, and it will fall out of the league of the liberal democratic order. And the United States is important to South Africa in the sense that the economic and diplomatic and cultural relationships across the Atlantic are essential to determining which direction Africa goes. If the tie with the U.S. is fundamentally broken, it will later also be broken with the rest of the Western liberal order, and South Africa will ultimately fail in key respects. If the tie is well established and excellent relations on all those three levels occur, then South Africa should ultimately succeed.
Frans, is what you're telling us potentially then a repeat of what we saw in 1985 when B.W. Botha stood up and wagged his finger at the Rubicon speech, and thereafter Willard C. Butcher of Chase Manhattan Bank stopped all loans to South Africa? We became a capital exporter. There was massive divestment from this company, this country. Interest rates went to 25%, etc. Are we at one of those moments?
We're at a similar moment. That's exactly the thing to remind people of. That he wagged the finger. Chase Manhattan said, we won't roll over the loans. And South Africa is essentially bankrupt. What's very different is at that moment, there was a second parallel process in place in order to help maintain the relationship. Much of that was the Sullivan Principles era, and what had happened in the background is Americans with foresight, drawing heavily on Chester Crocker, who was then the Assistant Secretary of State's constructive engagement policy, had been to see key South African leaders and had said to them, look, the American business community is going to break from many of the, certainly the petty apartheid prescriptions and regulations, and are going to begin treating South Africa as if it is already a reformed kind of a state. And in one of those engagements, the relevant minister also wagged his finger at the chap who'd gone to see him and said, you do not think that you can push this country around. We won't tolerate this, similar to the contemporary response to the U.S. And in that meeting, the minister then asked his aide to leave the room and fetch the tea or something. And when the young aide had left, who was obviously there to supervise the minister, because you can never trust the minister, the minister said to the chap who can't to see him on behalf of the Americans, listen, he said, what you guys are doing is the most important thing that could happen in this country, and we support you. We need to change. My government will have to attend. You know, we've got to keep our end up. You know, all that. It's still pretty early in the process. So there was a very important parallel process underway that sought to salvage the relationship and use American investment as a constructive input to help South Africa reform to a point where it would, after the moment of reform, ultimately 1994, remain a, or be, become a, evolve to be a liberal democratic state. One of the dangers in this moment is that those same parallel structures of the same foresight, ability, and sophistication are not in place, and therefore the relationship here can fracture. I don't think broadly, my experience of talking to people, what you read in the South African media, that there's a proper understanding of the issues that are at stake. And if that doesn't change, then it's going to be very difficult to repair this relationship or indeed hold the GNU together and the implications of that. So that would be the first place to start. What has come to pass is that the ANC has neutralized the DA. It has placed the DA in a position where the DA is implementing historical ANC policy positions, even where these run firmly against historical DA positions and even against cabinet promises that the DA contested last year's election.
Cyril Ramaphosa has written a piece for a publication called Foreign Policy. It's based in Washington. And, well, to say it was it's going to get up the noses of the Americans is an understatement. Just to put it in context, Foreign Policy magazine, how relevant is it?
Well, very relevant. It's a prominent international publication. And the message you place in it, regardless of who you are, is one that will be picked up within, you know, a matter of hours by serious foreign policy people around the world. I thought it was a very aggressive attack that essentially said to hell with the United States and with the Trump administration and with Israel and with the Israeli leadership. I don't think they could have put it any firmer than that in the way in which they conveyed the message. Well, I don't see the economic sense in it. You know, the ANC last week from the SRF got a very bad poll number, the lowest it's been. It's down into the 30s now. The few days ahead of that, there's great difficulty in even presenting the budget because the tax increase, the VAT increase is so complicated and so politically unpopular and would cause such great further damage, even to the ANC's own voter base, had that gone through. You're also in a position where the growth outlook for the South African economy is sitting at sub 2%, perhaps closer to 1% of GDP. We know that at that level, it's not possible to close the unemployment gap that the ANC itself needs for its longer-term political survival. And the most important number is fixed investment to GDP. That sits at about 15%, and that, at that level, it's consistent with a 1.5% economic growth rate. But to take the economic growth rate to, let's say, near a 4%, you need to lift fixed investment to GDP to around 25%. And foreign policy positioning along the lines of what we saw yesterday in a Foreign Policy magazine, I don't see how that leads to the economic solutions, the investment increases that are necessary to improve living standards in South Africa. And ultimately, too, and this is the great irony of the thing, under the leadership of Mr. Ramaphosa, save the ANC from what might be the way things are going now, it's complete annihilation.
But just to close off with the recruitment by Donald Trump of Vladimir Putin, who was the ANC's best pal, how would that on a global stage impact, and would that have anything to do with this very aggressive reaction? On the one hand, the ANC, for the first time, voting for Ukraine at the United Nations against Russia, and for this, and the second time, this article.
Well, I mean, I've probably said it on your show before that I had a somewhat different take on what precipitated the war in Ukraine. and that the idea of pure unbridled Russian aggression, simply rolling over the border, and was a bit overdone, and that NATO's expansion did threaten Russia. It certainly expanded beyond initial agreements, and that possibly, in the view of some Russian analysts, there had been green-lighted an attempt to mass forces in the east of Ukraine and try and drive right through through the east and cut off the Crimea and the Russian port at Sevastopol. And there are Russian analysts around who would say, and they make a case that you have to listen to very closely, that Russia's actions were defensive in the main. The Russian conflict further didn't make a vast amount of strategic sense for the Western world, given that Russia might easily be turned as a buffer or bulwark against Chinese expansion. And Russia and China's relations aren't excellent by any means. And if Russia feels threatened by Europe and NATO on the sort of left flank, on the right flank, there's similar concerns around China. And in addition, the war was completely futile from the start, the idea that it could be won. And part of that futility, and this is particularly bad, was that the Europeans never committed the resources to Ukraine to actually stand a chance of beating the Russians. So it became this meat grinder with tens of thousands of young men sent to their deaths for no good reason at all, only to ultimately settle the conflict along the lines of the old Minsk Accords, which is what Henry Kissinger had suggested as this before this meat grinder played out, and is probably now what's going to happen in some respects. But the fascinating thing is that the whatever little group, and I don't think this is the ANC en masse at all, whatever little group is commanding this South African foreign policy move that you saw yesterday in Foreign Affairs, is so utterly hostile to the Americans that they've even flipped the position on the war in Ukraine, and now have tried to gang up with the Europeans against the Americans. My sense of it, Alec, is that there is a small little core somewhere inside the government and the ANC that has captured South Africa's foreign policy machinery, and that they're driving that foreign policy for an object. I mean, this is we see this time and time again, driving foreign policy for whatever the objective is, but entirely at odds with the interest of the country and with its people, and entirely at odds ultimately with the interest of the ANC itself.
So much has happened, though, in the last 2 weeks since our last conversation, which has been viewed by more than 300,000 people. 320,000 views last time I looked at it. Time for a catch-up. So, Franz, what are we to make of all of this? Clearly, when it comes at you, all these news headlines, as a South African, you on the one hand getting buffeted and thinking, well, it cannot get any worse. And on the other hand, you get these little glimmers of hope that say it can get better. But behind the scenes, second level thinking, the kind of stuff that you do, what are you making of all this?
Well, the country is just changing, and it's just changing very quickly. But what causes it to change, I think, is relatively well understood. That in the immediate period after becoming a democracy, South Africa's economy performed relatively strongly relative to what would happen today or over the past decade and a bit. We increased the number of people in employment quite sharply. Standards of living were up strongly. All those indicators tell the same story. The ANC did very well in many respects. And as a consequence of that, material circumstances of people were improving. And support for the ANC remained at strong levels and actually increased a little bit, while levels of protest action diminished. what happened in the decade or 15 years leading to today is that the level of fixed investment came off strongly. As a consequence, the country couldn't maintain the growth rates that it had been holding between really, you know, and through the 2000 to 2008. Job growth stagnated. Think of this. This is an amazing number, Alec. During the era of Mandela and Mbeki, South Africa was creating about 500,000 net new jobs per year. And during the era of Mr. Ramaphosa, that's down to between 50 and 70,000. It's totally collapsed. And South Africa is a free society in the main. You can do what you like. You're not necessarily charged with treason, to use a contemporary example, for being critical of the government. And as a consequence of that, and the fact that we hold open and free elections, when people's material circumstances, the lives they live, do not improve, they begin to look for political alternatives. And that's still all that's going on at the moment. And the ANC got hammered last year, 40%. It has subsequently done absolutely nothing to address the core reason for the collapse in its support, which is that South Africa's levels of fixed investment are too low to create the economic growth, to create the jobs for the ANC to recover. Fixed investment levels are something you measure as a share of the size of the economy. And South Africa's number sits at about 15% at the moment. And that's perfectly consistent with the economy growing at 1% or 1 and a bit. In order for the economy to grow at levels of 4 or 5%, and that's important because at that rate, we would reduce our unemployment rate to 10% over the next 20 years. We need to lift levels of fixed investment by 10 percentage points at least, from the current 15% to 25%. If you wish to survive or thrive politically as a South African government, that should be your single objective. And if you achieve it, you will be very politically successful. You'll command a stable governing administration. But there has been no effort in that direction since the ANC's defeat, and as a consequence, its support continues to slide. More dramatic than that, even, is in these recent numbers, we tested what would happen if there was an election without Mr. Ramaphosa. So he's not an option. He's not. Don't factor him into your thinking as ANC leader. Now, a result like that, it gives you an indication of direction. Don't worry about the precise number because it must still happen. And how it happens will determine how people respond to it and who his successor is and all of that. But with that, ANC support went into the 20s. So this is a party that's in very serious, real serious trouble. But not even the experience of last year's election defeat appears to have been able to inspire the actions to close the fixed investment gap from 15 to 25% to get the growth rate back to 4 or 5. Well, what rate do emerging markets grow at around the world? The average growth rates of around 4%. South Africa, the last 15 years, 1%. Why? Fixed investment here is 15%. Emerging markets is 25% plus.
If society is changing so much, why would it really matter to Johannesburg if Helen Zille were to throw her hat in the ring and, as she says, she wants to, and become the mayor there? Can she make that much of a difference if we are moving in this direction towards almost privatization of so many parts of society?
You know, Alec, at first, when we became aware of this, I thought, yeah, maybe, you know, Johannesburg's difficult. Zille's such an important figure inside the DA. Is she kind of trading down, and what would the implications of that be? Well, we've jettisoned all that thinking. We have another view on this now, that this is the biggest political chess move in the country in more than a decade. And should she, the elections are likely early 2027. So she's got a good year plus on the campaign trail in Johannesburg. Johannesburg is not in a good place. It's deteriorating. The city government is not able to arrest that deterioration. The provincial government is not able to arrest the deterioration either. And should Helen Ziller over the next year be able to position her campaign in Johannesburg in such a way that she wins the city with a majority, because that's important, in the local elections, likely early 2027, and then, which she is capable of, lead a process over the next year or 18 months to stage some kind of recovery in the city, which isn't difficult given how far it's fallen. Based on our understanding of a lot of other data, we think that achievement will be perhaps the thing that breaks a big block of the ANC vote for the DA come the election in 2029.
Parallel drawn for us yesterday by Andre de Rita, who told us all about how we were today and said, no, it's not today, it's back to 1989. And also talking to a member of the tribe who I know very well, who's in the audience as well, he explained how he went with John Marie, you remember John, to meet with F.W. de Klerk. And he says that he's not sure that he was the person who changed his mind, but certainly the mind was changed. F.W. was going one way, he transformed his view, and the country transformed. Now, if you have a look at where we are today, we surely at a similar point as Andre was unpacking yesterday. How would you rate the chances of Ramaphosa being A, humble enough, and B, accessible enough to a different viewpoint to the one that seems to be infiltrating him 100%?
It's a different moment to 89 in the one respect that everyone that knew anything knew by the 80s how the transition would end. It just took the inflection point of the collapse of the Soviet Union. No one really doubted that the ANC would govern the country, and people had understood the ANC a little bit, had a clear enough sense about how it would do that. So the moment was different in the sense that the old regime was failing, and the new regime would be exactly that. It would be a large nationalist footprint, etc. This time the moment's different in that the old regime is fading, and there is nothing of a similar sort of stature waiting in the wings to come in. So it's different in that one respect. I think it's right that de Klerk understood that the tide had turned and that he needed to act. And I think Ramaphosa's nature, or is certainly the longer-term history, is a very different kind of person and will instead just allow events to overwhelm him and his party. And I think I've made the point on your show before that the idea of Ramaphosa, we don't think exists. We don't think he's real. He doesn't exist. The great union leader who brought the mining industry to heel, we think was actually Julian Ogilvie Thompson and others, Michael Spicer, Bobby Godsell, and that Anglo saw in Ramaphosa this catalyst to change the country, but had no need to claim the credit for that themselves. I think they were much more influential than anything else. The second time you see Ramaphosa, he's this great negotiator who's outfoxed the Nats, but the Nats knew, and they weren't perhaps in the entirety the highest caliber group of people. And in any event, Mandela was the negotiator with Effia, and the negotiations were directly between them. And the others played a very important role, and not to minimize it. I mean, but that's overdone. And then the third time you meet Ramaphosa, he's this great industrialist, this sort of Steve Jobs, Elon Musk. So, and then the fourth time you meet him, the environment's different. He doesn't have Ogilvie Thompson whispering in his ear, or Mandela, or someone else, and he faces a party that's run out of most of the things one needs in the government, from money to electricity, and support and confidence, and
And the his nature is to try and find the middle ground between competing objectives in his party, which were ideological and corrupt in the main. So the middle ground between that is well, 40% and headed for 20% in Gauteng. And I don't think it means that he's a terrible person or anything of that at all. He's just not had to put it this way. Had Ramaphosa inherited a country that, where when he took power, that economy was growing at 4 or 5% and had a 10% unemployment rate and lots of electricity, I think he would have gone down as one of the great African leaders. But what he inherited and his nature in responding to that were the wrong combination for the ANC. And then rather than being its savior, he is the person who sees it burnt to the ground. And Van Onselen, again, when I asked him what's the key formula to be successful in South African politics, Gareth's answer is to create the realistic belief in the mind of the voter that by voting for me, your life will get better. And I don't think there's anyone around at the moment that does that in a compelling way yet. And that explains Stay Away.